What's up, everybody? Welcome to Human, Humanity's United Martial Arts Network. I'm Shane Faison, joined by my co-host here, my very good friend, probably the toughest guy I know, mentally and physically, Marcus Koval.
Thank you.
And very excited for our special guest today. For the first episode, not only a martial artist himself, but a history professor, an author of multiple books, host of very successful podcasts, including History on Fire, Daniele Bellelli. How are you, sir?
Good, man. Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, very excited. And I just want to say first, I think I'm very excited to have you as our first guest simply because of your accent. I think people are going to hear this.
What accent?
Like, this is very professional. Who is it? And you just have a very wise sound about it.
What accent? What,
exactly.
I could pass for like straight out of Kansas, right?
yeah, I'd say so. What is that? Italian, correct?
Yeah.
And speaking of accents, Marcus, what is you have like a mixed hybrid mutt.
You know, everything. South Africans, a lot of times, a lot of people think I'm from South Africa, but it's from moving around so much. So I can actually understand why they think that, even though I've never been to South Africa. But from Sweden originally, lived in England for many years. So it's the British mixed with having lived in Mexico, Germany, France, and now the United States of America. How long have you been here, actually?
Long time, since 1992. I was 18 years old when I moved out here, and so I came right out of high school, so it was, it's been a while.
High school? What brought you to the U.S. right out of high school?
Italian high schools are all right. They're actually much better than American high school on average, but college sucks. College flat out sucks. Like, university in Italy is sort of just dead and pointless in the way it's done. And also, besides just university, my general outlook on life is like, I could pretty much see what my life could be like for the next 50 years. And I was like, I'm not that thrilled with the prospects out here. And US had this feeling of like, I have no idea what's going to happen there. And that's kind of fun. It could go really bad. It could go really good. There's more possibilities in that sense. And I mean, some of it is the rhetoric of, you know, more possibilities in US, but the reality is, yeah, there are, you know, it's both good, bad, somebody.
Knockout.
There has been a knockout in our figurines set up on the table, but.
Why do you say that about the colleges in Italy? Is there more of a focus on the arts there?
No, I think what happens with universities that, for one, it's most people don't attend. And to me, like, most of the point of going to college is meeting other people. It's not what you're actually doing. Mm-hmm. So if you start with the fact that a lot of people, there's very little attendance required, is more, you know, people study their stuff, go give the exam, off they go. So you are still stuck with the largely irrelevant material that you're studying most of the time. And on top of it, you don't even have that much of the social aspect. So I'm like, what's the point?
Right. You know? No, that makes sense. So growing up in Italy, what was that like? Did you start training martial arts?
Started a little bit in Italy. Yeah. I started much more seriously when I moved out here.
Okay.
And I had started a little in Italy. I was kind of dabbling, trying to get a sense of what I wanted to get into. And then I got way more out here.
What did you start with? What style?
You know, I watch Kung Fu movies, so I was all like, you know, just very... So I started out a lot with Chinese styles initially. And
you're a seventh degree black belt.
Yeah, I mean, that shit to me is like, doesn't mean anything, you know? It's like the old... Because, you know, in combat sports, if you have a certain ranking in judo or jiu-jitsu or something like that, that usually means something, because it's like, that means you can... probably beat 90% of people in the room of a lesser rank, right? There are exceptions, but most of the time, you know, you are there because you're better.
Yeah.
A lot of the more traditional arts ranking is based on, you know, you're a nice person, you show up, you put in the time, and your ranks keep adding. And, you know, there are some people who are ranked in more traditional arts, and they're actually badass, contrary to public reputation of traditional arts, who actually can use them, and the majority of people can't. And there's a bunch of people who are just terrible, who are like, yeah, you're 34th degree black belt, whatever the hell. And he's like, come on, man, you can't even run from here to the garage door. You know, it's
now,
like,
what is that an American thing or is that a style thing? Like gyms that will hand out belts like that?
I think what happens is it boils down to methodology. You know, to me, the dilemma of martial arts is that training wise, we are simulating something. Because, you know, if martial arts are about real fighting, well, you cannot train real fighting literally, because you kill each other. You know, if you actually fight as you would on the street, everybody walk away with a concussion or without eyes every other lesson. You can't do that.
Right.
So then there's the two routes that different martial arts take that are the more cooperative control training, where you can use any technique. So you are hitting all the right targets, but of course you need to be very restrained because otherwise you kill each other. Or you go the combat sports route where you limit a lot the targets and what techniques you can use, but you can go full blast, full power, everything else. They both have their plus and minuses, you know. It's like, to me, combat sports are essential because otherwise people can go into fantasy land about, I would do this and I would just poke him in the eye. And it's like, no, you have no idea what you're talking about because you're not used to dealing with the adrenaline, the speed, the resistance, all that stuff.
The pain.
But at the same time, I think there's a bit of delusion on the combat sports aspect as well.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, like, I've seen it so many times, people who get into street fights and they are clearly trained and they do all sort of ridiculously stupid stuff. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've seen somebody who shoots a double, get the takedown, get on top, is in top mount. And, you know, if this was in the cage, you're dominating and everything. And like some random girl off the crowd walks up, kick him in the head and knocks him out because he's like, that's her boyfriend that is getting beat up. And so he's like, those were good tactics for sport. You haven't really figured out that you're not one-on-one. They are. And so a little bit of the more self-defense mindset is not a bad idea to mix in with the combat sport training.
I agree 100%. I know, Marcus, you do too.
100% through Krav Maga, and you see it. But you've covered that a few times on fight tips, right? A few, you know, different situations. I know I've seen a similar video where there's a guy on top and a girl comes up and kicks him in the face. It's a really sad case. I hope the guy survived, with a Brazilian MMA fighter. He was really, really talented and well-known. He was in the wrong, and he slapped a girl at a gas station, and that he shouldn't have done that, obviously. But it's funny to talk about what you just said, street fight versus a cage fight. While they're still inside of the gas station where you can buy things, he's in a confined space and he's fine. But there's a lot of guys with this girl and her boyfriend and so on. And you've seen them come out and fight outside, and his friend gets hit with a pipe. I know he was in the head and I know he was in a coma. I hope he survived that. You know, no one deserves a beating like that. But from a street fighting standpoint, don't ever get into an open space where you can have someone coming up from behind you, you know?
Right.
And that's such a fundamental mistake. But just like you said, you know, at the same time, any martial art, if you want it to be for the purpose of self-defense, you got to incorporate sparring. If you don't, it's not going to work.
I think even more than sparring, though, it is mindset, it's strategy. Because like you said, ground and pound would work great if there's a ref there and there's only two guys in the ring besides that. But when there's other people, a soccer kick's a soccer kick. Doesn't matter if you're not gonna take one of those to the face, you're going down. You're going out.
That's why I love combat sports. I mean, I probably feel more comfortable on the ground with jiu-jitsu than anything else, but for street purposes, would I ever want to go to the ground unless I have no choice? Hell no.
Right.
You know, it's like, I love it in the gym. I love it for MMA. I don't like it for street.
You know what? This is a question that pops up all the time on my channel, but what do they say? They ask, what is the best combination or what is the best martial arts for street self-defense? How would you guys answer that?
I think the question is formulated right because it's asked for a combination, because I don't think there's one thing that's going to be it, right? Because you do need to know, in terms of combat sports, how to do takedowns. So either judo or wrestling or sambo, something for takedowns. You do need to know once you're on the ground, so something like Brazilian jiu-jitsu, have that kind of submission savvy type of thing. You do need to strike. So Muay Thai, kickboxing, whatever that may be. And you do need to have a self-defense tool to the thing that allows you to think of, I'm not fighting one guy, I'm fighting multiple opponents. How do I put that guy's body in the way of the next guy so that he slows down the attack? Or I'm attacking actually the right targets. I'm not throwing a inner thigh kick to the thigh, which is like, that's great for sport, but how about you hit him in the balls? That works a lot better. And, you know, it's not a huge adjustment, but unless you train it, it's just not going to be there.
In the heat of the moment, you have to have trained it.
Yeah.
And I agree. You know, you need a little bit of everything. There is, but I think to me the right answer is never the martial art, but always the martial artist. Mm-hmm. And in the end of the day, who can implement their game plan, even though it's not a game,
sure,
because it's a real situation. I am, you know, a Krav Maga instructor, mm-hmm, and obviously, but it's also a reason why I've dabbled with all martial arts, and I have respect for all styles of martial arts. But a couple of things that people often don't take into consideration when you prepare, when I fight in an MMA fight or kickboxing fight, I sign a contract. I know who I'm fighting, where I'm fighting, what time I'm fighting. I prepare for that one opponent, and the fight starts when the referee says fight. I'm warmed up, I've stretched out. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, street situation, one, escalate very quickly usually. You might be wearing jeans, so you can't, mm-hmm, kick anymore. You don't have time to warm up. You don't have time to stretch out. And not just that, like you said, the mindset, you know, mm-hmm, I'm not in the mind. If I'm in the middle of taking groceries and putting them in, now I got to switch that to, I'm either going to get killed or kill. Sometimes that's exaggerated, but that can happen. Mm-hmm. And it does happen. So, but I agree. You need to, even if you don't want to go to the ground, which means you still have to understand the game, because you need to stop the takedown. Yep. And if you don't know how to do a takedown, you can't stop a takedown.
Yep.
You have to do a style where, like you said, striking, and where people are hitting you back, where you do, even though they're not trying to hurt you, when you increase your adrenaline and stress levels, because you do not, any martial art coaches say, all you have to do is this. Anytime when it starts with all you have to do,
yeah,
is
it's
this,
like never gonna happen. Never gonna work. Of course. You mean the master can just hit them in the balls, doesn't work every, which, you know, it's funny because of course it's a joke, right? That's every traditional martial art is like, just hit them in the balls and poke them in the eyes. At the same time, it kind of works, you know, a lot of the time is without turning to master can, it's like, hey, there's something to be said about that. That
how old is Krav Maga? It's fairly new.
Yeah, right? You know, good, nice. Putting me on the spot. I don't know.
I could be wrong, but for the viewers listening, they could fact check. I thought it was like 70s, like 1970s.
So it was introduced by Emil Lichtenfeld, the founder of Krav Maga, in the 30s. His dad was a police officer who trained different martial arts. In a way, the original mixed martial arts, where you realize you do need some judo, boxing, wrestling. Moved to Israel and then, you know, developed this system, Krav Maga. And then what I like about Krav Maga and Emi's fundamental thinking of martial arts was take the best from different styles, put it together as a system. If we find a better way of doing it, let's abandon the style, the way we were doing things, and leave the ego out, and then let's do it this way.
It's awesome.
It is. And, you know, one of his original rules was there will never be combat or competition in Krav Maga, because when you have competition, you need to have rules. When you have rules, you limit yourself, like you just said. And that's why you can't have competition in Krav Maga. But just like a lot of styles, when you have people that were on the right track, like Bruce Lee is a great example as well, they were on the right track or developing something, but then when that person is no longer there, you don't have that leader who's willing to try new ways and find new ways. So it gets stuck at where it was, and then it becomes, well, this is the way of the founder.
Yeah.
But their vision was much bigger, and then you don't see that developing further.
See, because the reason why I ask is we could sit here and name a ton of different martial arts that originated thousands of years ago, hundreds of years ago.
Mm.
But are they all focused on sport competition? Are there any other ones that focus on solely self-defense?
Why don't we ask the history professor?
Well, yeah, I think and I think that's one of the things about martial arts where, you know, you hear the, oh, this martial art that has been in existence for centuries, and then you start looking into it and you're like, yeah, probably not. Because a lot of the arts have been changed so much over time that the odds that when the historical sources are this thin, suddenly, if you go back, you know, if you look at the last 150 years, pretty much every style has changed so dramatically in the span of just from one decade to the next. So to expect that suddenly when historical sources are really thin, nobody was changing and you had these unchanging styles that would last for centuries is like extremely unlikely. Really? You know, even if you look at something like judo, right? Yeah. If you look at like what Japanese jiu-jitsu styles were in the 1850s, what judo became by the 1880s, what judo is by 1920, what judo is by 1950, they have nothing to do with each other. I mean, they vaguely have to do, you know, a hip throw is a hip throw, you know what I mean? There are only so many ways to use the human body, right. But But those arts evolve constantly. And if you look at pretty much any martial arts over the last 150 years, there's almost nothing that was done exactly the way it was done 150 years that is done today that way.
So that what you just said, if you look at martial arts 150 years ago, I don't think anyone, and you're much more in depth with this than I am, have you, as you know, it's very few, I believe, history professors that have fought mixed martial arts and train heavily mixed in martial arts, have a girlfriend that fights professionally. Is that something that you have done, diving into the tradition?
Yeah, I very much like, and of course, very often you run into stumbling blocks because sources are so thin that sometimes you just don't know. You know, you can take the best educated guess, but there's definitely the mythology of martial arts history versus what you actually know about martial art history are two entirely different universes, you know? And you do get the feeling that the further the art goes, the more it's 99.9 part myth and one part, maybe a tiny bit of history attached to it, you know.
Is that like, just for martial arts, or is that all history?
No, I think it's in general, you know, it's like, that's how it is, you know. There's a lot of stuff that we take for fact, but do we have any evidence for it? Not really, you know, or that evidence is so thin that it's like, yeah, we have evidence from somebody who wrote about it 85 years later, word from a guy whose cousin said he was there, but he was mildly drunk, but his other friend wasn't totally drunk, and he said that he saw it, and it's like, yeah, okay, thanks. That's not the most reliable stuff ever, you know?
What's the saying? Any history lies in the hands of the winner of the war?
That's how it is, right? It's like, that's the problem with history, is that we expect it to be, you know, there's the great book of history that you crack open and it tells you exactly as it happened. And what you really realize is that what we know is maybe 2% of what there is out there to know, and the rest is a lot of educated guesses. So what you don't know is way more than what you know about any historical fact. And so, but I guess the trick with martial arts is that ultimately there are, you know, all human beings have two arms and two legs. There are only so many ways you can throw somebody. There are only so many ways you can hit somebody. So I'm actually making two mutually contradictory points, which they are not contradictory because that's just the way life is, but they definitely sound contradictory, which is on one end, everything is changing. And so if you think that something martial arts as is practiced today existed 200 years ago, it's probably delusional. At the same time, there are only so many ways you can move. So people stumble on the same techniques that would look revolutionary today. It's almost guaranteed that people have done that at some point in the past. But the package around it looked probably very different, you know? I was looking at, because my girlfriend, her family's from Cambodia, and, you know, I was talking with a lot of the people out there who tell me that right now all they care about is the striking game, right? They get bored to death with the grappling. They don't like the ground fighting. But if you look at, like, the temples at places like Angkor Wat or something, you see, like, I saw it, there was this carving, beautiful carving, where there's this guy with gable grip from behind, the guy in the front applying a kimura to break that thing. It looks like Sakuraba Hinsu Gracie on the walls of Angkor Wat, like, 1,000 years ago. You know, it's like... Wow. Or I saw a sculpture, this blew my mind. It's like 2,000-year-old Roman sculpture where it's represented this mythical fight between humans and centaurs, you know, the half-man, half-horsing.
That didn't happen?
And the centaur has the other guy on the ground and he's applying a heel hook on the human. And you're just like, what? What am I looking at? It's like a perfect heel hook, right? Yeah. Which is...
And what year were these created?
This was probably about 2,000 years ago.
Whoa.
So it's just, that's what I mean. You know, so it's like some stuff you could be dropped in the middle of like a pancration match 2,500 years ago and you would recognize 80% of the techniques, right? So there's a continuity there.
Right.
At the same time, the whole package, the training methodology, the way the things were put together changes all the time. You know, it changed almost from one generation to the next, forget over hundreds of years, you know?
That leads me to a two-part question. The first one, there's no arguing that we live in the best time for martial arts right now. Would you agree?
I think that's, you know, the range, what we are exposed to today, information-wise, is amazing.
Do you think the athletes now are at the peak of humans? human potential.
I mean, 100 years from now, I'm sure he would look like, ha, those guys thought that was the peak of human potential. What right, dumbasses, right. You know, it's like.
Because there's the argument, if Bruce Lee were around today, he'd be the UFC flyweight champ.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
Nobody knows.
Yeah,
It's like,
that's a safe answer.
It's like,
could upset a lot of people.
The guy is a beast. Clearly, he was amazing. He had great reflexes, great timing, great 10,000 attributes. But who knows?
Who knows if he even would have wanted to fight? You
right.
Know? Would he wanted to? Because, you know, he did so many things and he was a philosopher of
right.
martial arts in many ways, right? Would he...
Author.
Yeah. Would he have won? Did he really fight? He'd had a few fights, right? Actually.
Right.
Yeah. And
supposedly.
But, exactly. Or is it, can you... Have you looked
into
that?
Yeah, I mean, it looks mostly... Mostly is like... challenge fights, they're either street fights or they are challenge fight with somebody like, hey, you say that karate is best and you're talking shit to me, screw you, let's have it. And you know, you have those things where rules are kind of made up on the spot.
Yeah.
And so each one is different of those, you know, some had more rules, some had less.
So I have to say, you know, I've met a lot of martial artists over the years, and I know Shane has as well. I think you're one of, if not the most unique martial artist, especially someone that has actually fought in the cage.
Mm-hmm.
You don't look like your typical mixed martial art fighter, I have
what
to say.
You mean?
And that's a compliment, by the way.
Shave a head, the tattoos on my neck.
Yes. That's the thing that's missing, the tattoo on the neck.
Right.
What brought you into actually fighting?
I think I find it super scary, more than the average person. Like, I find physical violence extra disturbing. And I mean, you know, it's an intense thing for everybody, but some people are wired differently. Some people are not disturbed by that much. They have this natural toughness, at least in that area of life, where it really doesn't scare them that much. They can just go in, turn it on in a second, and just be ready to roll. I'm not built that way. I think that for me, that's one of the things that always made me feel tense. So my stomach closes up. And so it was interesting to me because it's such a primal thing. You know, you're dealing with conflict. You're dealing with, you know, somebody trying to impose their will on you, not philosophically, where you can always argue. You know, that's why, like, philosophical debates to me are bullshit because it's like, everybody can claim, everybody actually always claim they won, right? Because there is no objective standard way that you can prove that your argument was the best. You know, your supporters are always going to say that you won. The other guy's supporters always going to say that their guy won.
It's like a close fight.
Right. In MMA or in any kind of fighting, it's like after somebody drives their knee through your skull and you are knocked out for 45 seconds, unconscious, it's kind of hard to get back up and go, you know what? I actually won that fight. You know, it's like, it's pretty objective.
Yeah.
So to me, dealing with, I'm so much in my head all the time. So much of what I do is imagination related, is having to deal with something where nothing that I've ever read means crap when you step into the cage. Nothing, my ability to make, oh, listen to this sophisticated argument that I can make. Nobody cares.
Right.
There are punches flying for your head and you either get out of the way or you don't. There's a primal simplicity in this that I dig because it forces me not to lie to myself, not to live in fantasy land and to actually deal with, can I turn it on when it's needed? Or do I crash under pressure? You know, there are other pressures.
It's very honest,
isn't it? Yeah, it's super honest. And that's what I like, I think. It's like there are other pressures that don't bother me a bit. You know, you can put me in front of as many people as you want, put a microphone in front of me. A bunch of people are scared to death of public speaking. Mm. That does nothing to me. I don't feel like one little heartbeat extra. I'm just like, I'm just going to talk, big deal, you know. to me, that doesn't scare me. That's not a challenge. Fighting scares me. It is a challenge. And so when almost unfailingly I go through that, stomach tight, hard to breathe, muscles are tense, I feel out of breath before you even start, and there are all those feelings, and I'm like, shit, how can I handle this? You know, how can I... figure out a way because the bell is about to ring soon and it's gonna happen. So having to deal with that, I find it interesting in terms of personal development, you know, in terms of what it does for my overall personality.
That was a good answer.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It was a very honest answer. And I've had forgotten the line. And Vince, the anomaly, who is the Fight Tips coach, actually made, he posted not long ago from Fight Club. Fight Club. Yes. The whole thing, once you've been in a fight, how everything else tunes out. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I think it's a good thing. And an organized fight, I think everyone should have one in their life just to be able to say, I did that. Because everything in life does seem a little bit easier once you've been in a fight. In a controlled environment, obviously, not in a street fight.
Right. Yep.
And this is a topic, too, that you're pretty comfortable with, well-researched and talked about and experimented with, correct, Daniele? I mean, you've written a book, Not Afraid.
Sure, yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, which is, you know, Not Afraid is a goal, not the reality, because it's like, I think at one point I wrote in there, is like, the proper title should be Scared Shitless and Rightfully So, because it's like, that's more what you feel. But, you know, that feeling that sometime when you have these, because the reality is fear is at the roots of a lot of people's choices all the time in their life. But in day-to-day life, it's easy to hide. It's easy not to look at it. It's easy to pretend that it's not there because it's uncomfortable, it sucks, and you don't have to necessarily be honest with your fears in that dramatic of a fashion, because there's nothing just shoving that in your face saying, this is the fear, deal with it now.
Until it happens,
and a lot of people find ways to hide, find ways to look away, find, you know, ritualized combat, there's no looking away. You're there, you're locked in the cage for the next few minutes. That's what you're going to be dealing with, right? And so for me, it affords me a degree of honesty that then it's a little easier to carry out in other aspects of life, because the reality is that everybody has something they are afraid of. You know, more or less. It may not be the same things I'm afraid of. Maybe the stuff I'm afraid of is nothing to them, and vice versa. But the point is, everybody's got something that they are afraid of. That fear is going to affect how you carry yourself, how you relate to other people, how you are as a person just in general, how you, the life choices you make. So figuring out ways to deal honestly with your fears in a way that's not kamikaze, like, I'm just going to jump off the bridge and do this thing with parachutes. Like, it doesn't have to be that extreme. You know what I mean? It's like, it can be, you need to figure out what's comfortable that pushes the edges. So it's not that comfortable because you're stretching beyond your limits, but you're not stretching, like, if these are your limits, you're not going here, because that's, you're going to just damage yourself. Mm-hmm. You're just going 1 inch further, 2 inch further. Yeah. It's like stretching, push 3 inch further, you know, not 3 feet further, because you're going to wreck yourself and then you can train forever.
I like that metaphor.
Because that's what it is. It's like, it, you know, it's like lifting weights that way. It's like, you don't, just because you want to get strong, it doesn't mean you're going to put 500 pounds on the bench because you die, right? It's like, put whatever you can lift and now add 2 pounds, you know?
Gradual.
And on that subject of fear, one fear that's pretty uniform regardless of language people speak or religion they practice or where they live is that of death.
Yep.
And that's really what the book is about. It's funny in at times. It's very interesting to read your thoughts about stepping into the cage, and you're very honest. The way you talk about your thoughts before going into it. But the fear of death and overcoming, you know, the tragedy that you did with your wife passing away very abruptly. Talk to us about that.
Yeah. So what happened was back in 2009. We had my daughter, so we had a baby. We had a year where everything was mostly good, everything was fine. And then all of a sudden, around like kind of late 2010, my wife started getting some weird symptoms that were like, maybe you just tweak a shoulder, no big deal. And then they started look like more like neurological stuff, where it's like, okay, there's something else going on. But everything was happening really fast. It went from my shoulder hurts to, oh, damn, I can hardly walk in like 2 months. And so you see this, and you have no idea what's happening, all the exams, all the stuff. Initially, you can figure it out. Then they give her a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis, which is not fun, but it's manageable most of the time. So it's bad deal, but it's not the end of it. And yet she kept going worse and worse and worse and worse. And then like at one point in early 2011, they were like, oh, sorry, made a mistake. Not multiple sclerosis, is a brain tumor in a place that we can't operate and is super aggressive. And it's like, okay, well, that's where you realize you really have no, there's not going to be a good outcome out of it. You know, it's like there's no getting out of that. And in a weird odd way, that moment, like when we realized that stuff was going to end up really badly, it was almost easier than the previous 2 or 3 months where things were getting progressively worse, but you have hopes. And so you are kind of holding on to this hope in the face of all evidence. You're like, no, but it's going to work. And you're afraid of this thing that's going to be taken away from you, right? Mm. In her case, her life. In my case, her, right? But there's that sense of, whereas when you realize, like, that's it. It will be taken away. There is no if will be taken away. It's a done deal. It's over. Then you, in a weird kind of way, you almost relax. Because it's like, well, then the stuff that you are afraid of is already there. There's not even a use to be afraid of, because it's like, it's done. It's a fact. It's not a... And so at that point is, you know, she didn't want to do any, didn't want to do chemo, didn't want to do any of that stuff, because she was like, what am I going to do? Do chemo and live 6 more months? Who cares? You know, I'm not into... That's not going to help anybody. It's she didn't care, because it's like, unless I have a good quality of life, what am I doing, you know, to get 6 more months? What do I care? So she was like, wanted to get done as quickly as possible. And that was that. And so she then died in early 2011. And then by the time she died, you know, my daughter was 19 months old. So, of course, that was a bit of an intense process, because I had just the previous 3-4 months, I hardly slept. Right. Mm-hmm. Because it's like I had to work, take care of my daughter during the day, and somehow manage to work at the same time. And then
deal with grief.
Right. And then at night, one of the side effects of this whole thing is that my wife could hardly sleep. And that was the time when she handled it well during the day. At night is when all her fears popped up. Mm-hmm. So then at night, I'm with her and I sleep like 2-3 hours or something, and then the next day same thing, and the next day and the next day and the next day. So that was for, you know, a few 2-3 months, something like that. And then when she was gone, then, well, there's still my baby's 19 months old, you know. It's like that requires a lot of attention.
Yeah.
In the meantime, just to make it, spice it up a little, because otherwise it's too easy. You know, my work career is kind of going down the drain. Economically, stuff is going badly. So I have to figure out, you know, what to do as far as money goes. But even then, even when I was getting some possible opportunities, it's like, yeah, I cannot take that. It's like, yeah, that's a nice opportunity. And that takes me away from my daughter when she already doesn't have a mom, and now she doesn't see me 10 hours a day. I can't do that. So that's not an option.
So going from everything that you wanted, wife, child, mm-hmm. everything going, and then having that ripped away from you, and now being a single parent to a young daughter, who, by the way, now is so sweet and amazing. What kept you on your feet? What kept you to be able to continue going?
I think some of it, at least some of it, I do credit to martial arts, because there's that feeling of, you know, everybody is a hero when everything is going great, right? It's easy to show your best when all the conditions are there for you to shine. It's not fun, especially in martial arts, you know, when you're going against somebody who's way better than you, and is way better with you in every aspect. It's like, you're not gonna win this fight. You're getting your ass kicked.
Yeah.
And so the normal reaction is, if I have no hope of winning, why am I here? You know, I don't want to be in this fight. I want to tap out and go home, and let's do that. And when you push yourself to stay, not in the winning fights, not in the fights where you rally back and you win, those are epic and they are fun. No, in a fight where you're going to get your ass kicked no matter what you do. You know, you can do your absolute best and you're still going to get your ass kicked. There's something there that it makes you really tough. because, you know, anybody can hold on to hope is fighting on when it's hopeless. Yeah. That's a different kind of story. And so in some sense, in that scenario, it's just like, you know, first I had to take care of things when I had some hope. Then when there was no hope for my wife, well, it's like, well, she's not dead yet. So in the meantime, I need to try to make it as comfortable as humanly possible for her, trying to make her laugh, trying to do something that's, you know, it's there are last days or month or whatever. I need to make it good for her as much as humanly possible. That's the goal. All the other stuff is crap. I, you know, my own mental bullshit and emotion, and it don't really matter right now. When she's gone, well, now it's my daughter's turn. She needs me, you know, 110%. And so what would happen was I would give myself like 10 minutes a day, 15 minutes a day, where it's like, okay, you can cry, you can break down, you can have your moment. The universe sucks. I hate you. Okay, time is up now. You need to go back to changing diapers. Shut up and put a smile on, because ultimately it's not just you need to take care of stuff. You also need to make her happy. You know, she's going through a hard time. She doesn't have her mom no more. It's like, now figure out a way to make it good for her. And in that way, gallows humor come into place, because realistically you're dealing with a horrendous situation. But being able to find the kind of like, okay, what's next? You know, it's like, I got kicked in the ball so many times by now with this, that is like, but I'm still here. So there's that defiant aspect of like, screw you all. I'm still going, not only I'm still here, I'm actually going to find a way to smile right now in spite of it all. For her, because my daughter needs it, and ultimately then for me too.
Beautiful.
You know?
It's awesome.
By the way, a lot easier said than done, in the sense that I also, as much as in some way I got it done, in other ways I clearly didn't, because there were plenty of times when I was extra edgy and I would snap when I shouldn't have, when I was like, raise my voice, and it's like, he's a two-year-old baby who just spilled milk. Shut up. Why are you yelling at her? You know, like, that's just not right. That's, and that was just my own frustration with dealing with so much stuff. And again, nothing dramatic. You know, I'm not whacking her or anything. I'm not doing, it's not that, but it's still uncalled for. You know, it's still like, I shouldn't be yelling at a two-year-old kid. You know, that's not cool. And I don't care if you do it for 40 seconds, or it's still not cool. You know, you don't raise your voice with a kid who spilled milk. You're an asshole. It's just, you can't handle your own emotions and you're taking it out on this kid. And there have been enough times when I saw that. And, you know, kids push your buttons. You know, they do 10,000 things that piss you off. And so you're like, but you're like, yeah, she still doesn't deserve that reaction, so shut up and deal with it. But the other aspect too was, over time, I thought I was processing grief, and clearly I probably wasn't as much as I thought, because I saw my body started breaking in from stress. I started getting a bunch of, you know, stomach issues, and my back would get wrecked, and the next time I lift a weight, and my shoulder, it's like my body was just running, so I was stretching so many directions energy-wise, then my body was not in a happy place for a few years.
And what you just said, you know, you had to be there for your daughter. Have you had a chance to actually process your grief, and how are you today?
I don't know. I'm not sure, because the thing that puzzled me when all the obvious examples of stuff that is like, yeah, there's stuff still in you that you haven't processed, I thought I was processing. It's like, I wasn't shy about talking about it. I would very openly talk about what I felt and my emotions and this and that. So I thought that was enough.
But it's important too.
It's important, certainly. But it clearly was a prerequisite, but not enough to go to actually get the job done. It was like, that's needed, but clearly more had to be done. And I don't know what more is. I mean, I don't know that there's one thing that suddenly made me go click, now everything clicks. You know, it's been a process of dealing with crap and talking about it and trying to deal with my emotions, and then dealing with a little less crap the next year. And then, you know, each year has gotten a little better than the one before.
Nice.
So, but yeah, I'm not entirely sure. Like, even if I were to put myself in the exact same situation, would I handle it differently? I don't know. I don't know what I would do different, to be honest.
I know it's a gradual process, but was there a morning that you woke up and you just felt a little bit better? Like, and at what point was that?
I know, yeah, you know, there was, I had this dream. I still have that dream. I have this dream. I had it maybe 50 times since my wife died, where I have this dream that my wife come back to life and I'm excited, I'm happy, but there's also an element where I don't want to go back to the life I had, because I look at some other aspects of my life now, and in a weird kind of way, I'm happier now than I was back then. And of course, the second that comes up in my brain, I feel horrendously guilty. Because it's like, really, that's your first reaction. It's like, she comes back to life and your first reaction is, I'm so glad for you, but I don't really want to go back to have that life. You suck. What's wrong with you? And that thing, that weird survivor guilt that never made any sense to me. You know, when I read about it before, I'm like, what the hell is survivor guilt? It's not your fault. So you did what you could and there's nothing you did wrong. Why would you feel guilty? Well, I did big time, because it's like I almost felt guilty that I could enjoy life when she couldn't, you know. And so I had that dream time and time and time again. And one day I had that same dream and I actually say to her in the dream, and she's totally cool with it. She's like, of course, I get it. You know, you have your own thing going, you have your own life, it's fine. And so I was getting kind of a blessing from my image of her in the dream. And so I was like, oh. Just the fact that I can have that dream is probably a sign that I'm in a little bit of a better place than when I've been so far.
Yeah, a lot of people interpret dreams in different ways, and I'm a avid practicer of lucid dreaming.
Right.
I'm a big fan of that. But some people think it's energies or talking to the deceased. Do you think you were actually talking with
her? I have
no
idea.
Or was it? Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I've seen enough weird stuff in life to make me think that the universe is considerably weirder than I would think it is, according to a very three-dimensional model of reality.
Yeah,
but science. Of course, I don't know. You know, it's like there are, but yeah, there have been times where I was like, that was weird.
Yeah, yeah.
I was, once I had my daughter was, she was probably four. She called me in the middle of the night and she's like, oh, I felt a hand touching me. And I'm like, you're sleeping, you know, you had a dream and that's fine. And she looks at me kind of like, you stupid bastard. You're no, I still feel a hand touching me right now. And I'm just like, okay, that's a little weird. I don't know what to do with it. So come to sleep with me and just that way you'll relax. And the next day is like, before I even say anything to anybody, my mom calls me and she's like, oh, you know, I had a dream of Elizabeth, my wife. And, you know, I was telling her how your daughter, she's so kind of mad that she's beginning to forget her and she wants to be able to touch base with her. And she's, and she was telling me in the dream, no, I don't want to scare her. And I was like, no, go to her anyway. Let her know that you're there. And she goes like, isn't that a weird dream? And I'm just like, yeah.
It was the same day.
Yeah, same day. And so I was like, yeah, that's a weird dream. Holy shit.
Right.
It's like, now, do I believe that that means that's what happened for sure? That's there is a spirit? That, I don't know, you know? But it certainly makes you go, okay, maybe reality is interesting, you know?
Jeez.
Yeah.
Man, that's wild.
Do you have any questions from any
people? Yeah, so we went live on Instagram Live for the people who are watching after the fact. We got a couple questions. A little vague, but in the realm of history, people were asking, and I think we answered this one already, the same theory that we have a common ancestor, Pangea, is there a common martial art that we've all trained? But I think biomechanics. And
I think it's biomechanics.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there has been more exchanges over time than I think we're given credit for. I think the world was not as separated as we think, you know, when like Alexander the Great invades a big chunk of Asia and you're going to have, you know, Greeks practicing pankration, bringing their stuff, being in contact with people from India, with their native traditions, some of that stuff. Now, is it a one-to-one ratio where this thing is passed exactly as? No. Yeah. But has there been a lot of exchanges? For sure.
I love that. Another question was, what effects have martial arts had on cultures throughout history?
Oh, interesting.
I think cultures like change martial arts. Like I'm actually working right now on a series on Jigoro Kano, the creator of Judo, the founder of Judo, right? And one of the things that happened with him is that I really think that martial arts as we practice them today would not exist if it was for Kano. Because what happens is in Japan of the late 1800s, the popularity of martial arts is collapsing. Nobody wants to practice because is there are guns now. They just got their ass kicked by the Americans showing up, saying, open up your ports or we'll destroy you. And these guys still have the samurai and they are going against cannons. They are not going to go. It's not going to go well. So most people are abandoning the practice of traditional martial arts. Jiu-jitsu itself is seen as the pastime of thugs who just want to learn how to break somebody's arm, but they are Yakuza guys and no respectable person should be training martial arts. Because
what year is this?
This is like 80... The Americans coming into Japan was 1853. Okay. So the time between the next three decades or so is a period in which Japan goes super modern very fast. They go from this feudal society based on farming to being a modern power over the span of 30 years. As that's happening, they are throwing away most of their traditional culture, including martial arts. And Kano comes along, and he's kind of a nerdy guy. And he's almost the stereotype of like the Karate Kid story, right? Like weak guy who gets bullied a lot and so wants to train martial arts. He's empowered by it. He loves it. And he wants it to make it a legitimate thing that people are still into, right? But you cannot train it the way you did before because the world has changed. People have guns. People have, it doesn't work the same way. And so Kano invents this new model where he's like, no, you guys all misunderstood. This is not just about fighting. It's about becoming a better human being. Mm. And he's like, how exactly training to choke each other out is supposed to make you a better human being? He's like, yeah, you guys all got it wrong. And he's creating this whole rationale to adapt martial arts so that it has a function in a world in which you're not going to fight with jiu-jitsu a war. You know, that's not the way it's going to happen. And so he... In doing that, he creates a new function for martial arts, a new purpose for it in a way that people dig. And so in that sense, it's a way in which culture can change the meaning of a martial art. So it's not just how martial art changed the culture, it's also how the culture changed martial arts over time. And, you know, he creates the belt system. He creates all these things that are like the structure of modern martial arts is because Kano wants it to still make it relevant at a time when everybody thinks this is anachronistic, this needs to go.
Well, I have to say, I think he made it what it should be, which is even more important than being able to fight with martial arts,
right?
As we know, and the whole purpose of this podcast, which is how martial arts can actually help you even without having to get into a fight. One thing that you just said there with the belt system, I had learned, I don't remember from where, and I've even taught this to our students, that belts, the belt system was invented because everyone got a white belt, and then over time it got dirtier and dirtier, and you know a master had a black belt because it was proof that belt
right.
had gotten so dirty over time.
Yeah, I heard that a lot. I don't know. I mean, what I did read about Kano was that they say he borrowed the idea of a ranking system from actually Japanese Go, you know, the like chess type of game, that they had a ranking system, and he was like, oh, we should have that for judo too. And so he started this system of like three beginner rank, three advanced rank, and that was it, right? And then like a couple of years into it, after he gives his first couple of guys their first dan, he's like, you know what, let's make that belt black, let's signify something different when you step on the mat. And so you had a couple of his guys were really the first black belts ever in that sense.
Wow.
Now, is it possible that is exactly that was why? He's like, well, if you train long enough, your belt is progressively darker color and it doesn't look as new. So, yeah, we should make it the black. Who knows, right? It's hard to tell. But
at what point does it become purple?
Right, or exactly.
Red. Yeah.
Red is probably the blood, yes.
Green is mold.
Right.
You forgot to dry it properly. You shouldn't wash your belts. You
That's when staff, green belts is straight up staff.
So, as a martial artist, as a professor, what's something that you could recommend people that might not be that involved in martial arts, or even if they are, what's one thing that you feel that martial art has given you as an academic, as a professor, that schooling perhaps can't give you, or life can give you, but maybe in a difficult to find it in life.
I think the fact that you have to you have such immediate feedback on whether stuff is working or not, on whether you are any good or not. The measure, the sense of worth that you get from martial arts is different from the sense of worth that you get from other activities. Because so many, like to me, somebody praising my intellectual skills, I'm like, that doesn't mean shit to me. Because it's like, that's an opinion, you know? It's not a proven fact in a way that's been able to KO the next guys, you know? It's like, that's a fact. These other stuff are educated opinions. They are not. And to me, it's like, it's a healthy, it creates, usually, there are plenty of exceptions to that, but it can create a healthy relationship with your ego. Because on one end, you do get a measure of self-worth. It's like, hey, I started from here, and look at where I'm at now. I'm way better than where I started, and look, there are the people who start just where I was, and now I can clearly, I'm on top of the game. I win, quote-unquote. I'm better. I work hard, and I got results. At the same time, pretty much any single day, there's going to be somebody who's going to kick your ass. Who's like, yeah, still, there's... So it keeps it in perspective. It's like, you can't get too big of a head because there's always a guy who's better than you. It's like, you can be the best fighter in the world and you have no guarantee that you're going to win the next fight. You know, it's like, right, there's always a guy who's coming up who's like... And vice versa, you can't be too down on yourself because you see how hard work has made you better over time. So it gives you a realistic assessment of who you are, where you're at, how much hard work has paid off, and how much you can still don't get too ahead of yourself because there's room for improvement.
To answer your question, though, Marcus, and that was awesome, but I feel like there's so many different styles of martial arts that people should do some research. People should dabble because whether you're old, young, big or small, there's different levels of intensity of martial arts that you can train, even if it's just Tai Chi. And even I could even group yoga into martial arts. Yeah. Something where you're going to be around other people, where you're going to be challenging yourself, where ego is instantly smashed when you walk in the door. I think it's the healthiest thing for human beings is martial arts.
Agree.
That was great. I think this, I'm pumped. I'm like already thinking of how I'm going to market this first episode. We had the best guest on. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you guys.
This was really good. We talked about all the points that I wanted to hit. We briefly talked about samurai. I was hoping the word samurai would at least come up in that.
And it did.
We talked about destroying the ego. Man, this was great. Thank you again so much.
Awesome. Thank you guys.
Thank you, Daniela. And for anyone that wants to find out more about you, Daniela, where can they find you?
Google is nice to people, so it's like, if you can figure out how to spell my weird name, which I'm assuming you put in some episode notes or something, that, you know, you Google it and you will, you know, whether it's my podcast, whether it's books, whether it's anything else, internet is your friend.
Yeah, check out his podcast, History on Fire. That's your most popular, right? But you're doing
one here too.
This one is Drunken Taoist. Yeah, this is, speaking of multitasking, it is a shirt with... the hero of our story is making out with this woman while drinking wine and kicking a guy in the balls who's coming to attack him. Oh, so that's some good multitasking.
I'm
going to
take a picture.
Right,
I'm going to make that the thumbnail of this video.
Right.
And one last thing that, by the way, if you read, which you should, it's a good thing to do. His books are very, very good. And Not Afraid is something you don't have to have experienced loss to find motivation from the books. I highly recommend it. And, me and Shane spoke about this. You're a teacher. We need some homework. If you can recommend people to do one thing, what would that be?
In life, anything.
Anything.
Maybe a challenge. Really. Challenge then. Something that they can do in the next week.
Okay. Let me think. That's a good one. And I don't want to give you a bullshit answer. So let me think for 10 seconds about...
Everyone can meditate during these 10 seconds.
Okay, one thing that I find key in interpersonal relationships, like a lot of people do it, me included, I'm sure I've done it plenty of times. Sometimes it's even with loved ones, even with people you're close to, take a snarky tone because it's like, oh, I'm just joking, I'm just playing. But you know, you see those relationships where people are constantly putting each other down in a fun way. And it's like, no, ultimately, it's not that fun. Ultimately, you are creating, you are constantly kind of nipping at each other in a weird way. That's like, to me, in terms of communication, the people you choose to have in your life, that you choose to be close to, that you want, then you should be ridiculously nice to them. 99% of the time. Then you weren't making a joke once in a while, you know, but but 99% of the time being physically affectionate, letting people know that you care about them, telling them in whatever way comes natural, letting them know how much they are appreciated. Like, I don't get tired, you know, my daughter, my girlfriend, people I'm close to, I'm like, I want to let them. And it's not that it's like you've heard it like already six times today, so it's not that you really need to know it, but it's like it's a way to pass energy to me. So it's like letting the people in your life know how much they mean to you, how much you appreciate them, how much you value them. Everybody struggles with self-esteem issues. So having from somebody else the feedback that you mean a lot to them, that you are good to them, that you know them, you see them for their limitations, for their good stuff, and you still think they are awesome. That stuff is huge. So I think that's homework for the day.
I love it. There you guys go. For those of you listening, for the next week, hopefully it'll continue past just a week, but physically show, tell the people that you love them. I love that. All right, let's wrap it up. Daniele, thank you so much for coming on. Truly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Guys, if you're listening, check him out. Links will be in the description below.
Thanks, man.